So in a couple of days, it's going to be Independence Day. And, you know, many of us are going to be either grilling or cooling off at some body of water or lighting things on fire. And it's just an opportunity for us to celebrate the freedom that we have in this country. And so for us this morning, I want to talk through the idea of freedom. And so I'll give you a moment just with the people around you. Just talk about what comes to mind when you think about freedom, right? What observations, what emotions, what comes up when you think about what freedom means to you, right? I'll give you a moment to do that. All right. So freedom. All right, what were some of the thoughts, observations, things that came up? What came up to mind when you thought about freedom?
William Wallace.
William Wallace. That's nice. I like that. Wish I had an image of that, but I don't. Civil rights. Okay. Freedom for all people. Speech. So having the freedom to say what we want. Yeah. Being able to do what you want whenever you want to do it. You know, and I think that's, for me, that evokes a lot of the same emotion. You know, just thoughts of not having limitations or restrictions, right? Being able to do what we want to do. And I think for many of us, college kind of captured that idea, right? For the first time, being away from home, being away from parents, right? Being able to do anything we wanted. I remember when I moved to Austin for college and, you know, I would stay up late with friends watching movies, right? And this was before Netflix. So we had to physically go to a video rental store, for those of you who know what that was. You know, my roommates and I, we essentially lived in the gym, playing basketball all day, all night, not having to worry about a curfew. You know, I would sometimes skip morning classes just to sleep in. But, you know, having freedom, the biggest thing was being able to eat anything I could, right? Anything I wanted, whatever my parents wouldn't let me eat at home, that's what I would do. And a big go-to for me was obviously instant ramen. But my twist was ramen with Vienna sausages from a can, right? Yeah. Freedom, yeah. And I think for most of us, you know, when we think about freedom, we think of it in terms of autonomy and independence, right? We value freedom because we can live our lives on our own terms, make our own decisions. And yet, in the text that we're going to look at this morning, we're invited to actually view the paradoxical nature of freedom that God invites us into, where it's not about holding on or protecting the freedom for ourselves. This is what a Franciscan priest said about freedom. He said, "Freedom for both Jesus and Saint Francis was purely and simply freedom from the self, which is precisely freedom for the world. This is so utterly different than our American notion of freedom. In order to be free for life, we must quite simply be free from our small selves, or what we might call as our false self." And so the question I want to consider this morning, right, is how does God's vision and understanding of freedom differ from what we might consider to be freedom? And how are we invited into experiencing the paradox of God's freedom? So we're going to be exploring this letter that Paul wrote to the Roman church. And so if you could, we're going to be reading Romans 6, verses 12 through 18. So if you could read that with a neighbor, as is our custom here, it'll be on the screen. I'll give you a moment to do that. All right, so let's start in verse 12. It says, "Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, so that you obey its evil desires. Do not offer any part of yourself to sin as an instrument of wickedness, but rather offer yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life." And so, you know, when Paul's talking about sin here, he's not just referring to moral acts or a list of things that we shouldn't do, but he's actually addressing the larger perspective of us not becoming what we were created and intended to be. This is how N.T. Wright puts it. He says, "Sin is not just doing things God has forbidden. It is the failure to be fully functioning God reflecting human beings. And so the invitation we're given, right, is to move away from our compulsive and self-protective patterns and strategies that end up damaging intimacy between ourselves, God, and others. And Paul understands that sin is actually a systemic power, you know, of brokenness, of injustice, that prevents us from being fully functioning. It prevents us from being God-reflecting human beings. And so most of this letter that Paul writes is centered around what Jesus did to free us from this systemic power, right? And it's his death on the cross that was part of the process to give us freedom. And so the first paradox we see is that God's freedom doesn't come through fighting for or holding on to ourselves more tightly, but it actually comes through experiencing death, through letting go. You know, not only did Jesus model this, but he invited us to actually be part of this process as well. You know, he would say things like, whoever wants to save their own life will end up losing it, but whoever loses their life or lets go of their life for me will find it. Or he would say, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves or die to themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Now, Jesus knew that in order for us to experience life the way God intended, there were certain things in our lives that needed to experience death. Some of you might know Alain de Botton. He's a British writer, author. He wrote books like Essays in Love. And he was recently, a little while back, on This American Life, talking about the decisions we make about love. And he's more of a rationalistic, realistic guy when it comes to love. Not so much the romanticized version that we've been fed or that we tend to operate out of. And so sometimes he tends to criticize the idea of love based on intuition, right? That we just know, right? We know he or she is the one. He says, it'd be crazy for him to tell someone that he's just going to fly and land a plane by intuition, right? Or that he's going to perform surgery by intuition. And yet when people say that they're going to operate their love life out of intuition, no one thinks twice. But he thinks a lot more work goes into it than that. And so that's kind of where he's coming from. But here's a clip of his conversation with Ira Glass when he was reflecting on marriage and love.
So what would you say to other people getting married this month? What would you tell them?
Be incredibly forgiving for the weird behavior that's going to start coming out. You will be very unhappy in lots of ways. Your partner will fail to understand you. If you're understood in maybe, 60% of your soul by your partner, that's fantastic. Don't expect that it's going to be 100%. Of course you will be lonely. You will often be in despair. You'll sometimes think it's the worst decision in your life. That's fine. That's not a sign your marriage has gone wrong. It's a sign that it's normal. It's on track. And many of the hopes that took you into the marriage will have to die in order for the marriage to continue. That some of the headiness and expectations will have to die.
I'm laughing because this is so dark.
It's very dark. But in love, darkness is a real friend of relationships, because so many of the problems of love come from unwarranted optimism. And so we need to be dark about so many things. And let me say, relationships markedly improve when two people can make almost a blanket avowal. We're both kind of crazy.
You're married, right?
I'm married.
What's your wife say about all this?
Look, she's very funny. She's a pessimistic realist. On our 10th wedding anniversary, she dressed in black. And she said it was a funeral for many of her hopes. So she's quite dark too. But we're actually very hopeful about the course of love.
So good. So good. Right. But he goes on to explain that when unhealthy, romanticized expectations die, that's when we begin to fully understand ourselves. And we're actually able to receive our partner more fully for who they really are. And I love that story of his wife wearing black on their anniversary, right? She was acknowledging and even ritualizing the death of some of these expectations and hopes. And that was a necessary part in order to move into a more freeing and authentic experience of marriage. You know, Richard Rohr talks about this idea of dying before we die, that, you know, in order for us to truly live the way God intended, you know, we need to experience death to our own ego. He says that all religions in their own way talk about dying before you die. They are all indeed saying that something has to die. We all know this, but often religions have chosen the wrong thing to kill, which has given us a very negative image. In almost all history, it has always been the other, the heretic, the sinner, the foreigner that had to die. Seldom was it me. And he's saying that an unhealthy religion, right, creates fear. It creates a sense of self-preservation where we feel like we need to hold on tighter, where we need to insulate ourselves even more at the expense of others. But healthy faith, right? Healthy faith invites us to die before we die so that we can really live. And when we're able to understand what it means to let things go and for our false self to experience death, then we no longer fear death. And so for us, maybe a couple questions we can ask ourselves, right? What areas in our lives need to experience death? Right, or we need to let go of? What patterns, addictions, what expectations or assumptions need to die in order for us to experience freedom? Right, and maybe how might we symbolically or even literally dress in black to mark the death of those things? Sometimes the first step of simply acknowledging or accepting those areas is the beginning of us moving those things towards death and then moving our lives towards freedom. In verse 13, Paul continues. He says, "Do not offer any part of yourself to sin as an instrument of wickedness, but rather offer yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and offer every part of yourself to him as an instrument of righteousness. For sin shall no longer be your master, because you are not under the law, but under grace. What then? Shall we sin because we are not under the law, but under grace? By no means." And so here, you know, Paul is communicating a shift from law to grace. And it's a result of Jesus' death. And his death was solely motivated by love and forgiveness, nothing else. And because of that, Jesus was able to turn his act of death into grace. And so we're no longer operating under judgment and fear. We're free from a system of competing, of measuring, earning, or performing. And in this economy of grace, our value is not based on being worthy, being superior, or even being moral. However, Paul reminds us that freedom from the law also doesn't give us a free pass to do whatever we want either. Operating under grace is an invitation for us to explore and understand ourselves more fully and to understand God more fully. And so the second paradox here is that God's freedom doesn't come through practicing unfiltered choices where we can just do whatever we want, but it actually comes by practicing discernment through a lens of grace. In the text, Paul compares us to instruments, right? And instruments, right, they're neutral on their own, but it's how we use them that gives them their value. So instruments can be used for good or for evil, right? They can be learned and mastered, or they can be ignored and wasted. They can enhance other people's ability to live well, or they can abuse other people's ability to live well. And in order for us to understand how we use instruments the way they were designed and intended, right, it takes a process of learning, discovery, practice, and that's what discernment is. Pope Francis once said this about freedom. He said, "Before all else, be free people. Freedom means knowing how to reflect on what we do knowing how to evaluate and which are the behaviors that make us grow. Being free to always choose the good is challenging, but it will make you know how to live as courageous and patient people. And so, you know, we're invited to practice discernment and then choose what's good. Or how Paul describes it, choosing to be instruments of righteousness. And perhaps a better translation of righteousness is actually restorative justice. Right? So really, it just means we're participating with God to make things right in this world. And perhaps that's why Jesus gave us the Beatitudes, when he said it's the poor, it's the weak, it's the hungry, it's the heartbroken, right? Those are the ones who are blessed. That's why he spent so much time. That's why he lived with the social outcast, the marginalized. Because those were the only ones who could be loved and invited through a lens of grace. You know, St. Francis was a great example of this. Early in his life, he grew up in a family with wealth and privilege. And he finally came to a point where he voluntarily chose to live a life of non-possession. Right, and so he pursued a lifestyle of simplicity, of poverty. And based on one of the stories that was recorded about him, he had an extremely difficult time with lepers, which was true of everyone at the time. Right, he couldn't look at them. He couldn't be near them. He wouldn't touch them. Until finally one day, he was riding his horse and he came across a leper. And as he was discerning how to respond, for the first time, he actually saw the humanity in the leper. And so he got off his horse, he gave him a coin, and then he kissed him on the hand. He actually touched him. And a few days later, he actually moved into a hospice for lepers, and he kissed the hand of every leper there, and he gave them all financial support. And from his writings, he reflected on this encounter with the lepers, and this is what he wrote. He said, "The Lord gave me, Brother Francis, to begin to do penance in this way. For when I was broken, it seemed too bitter for me to see lepers. And the Lord himself led me among them, and I showed mercy to them. And when I left them, what before had seemed bitter to me was now turned into sweetness of soul and body." And so as he began to see people through a lens of grace, right, not only was he beginning to see the humanity in people, but he was beginning to experience freedom from his fears, freedom from his own judgment of people. And for us, maybe a question we can ask, right, is how are we practicing discernment through a lens of grace? And as we try to see through a lens of grace, right, who might be the lepers in our lives that we need to experience freedom with? I'll admit, you know, that discerning with a lens of grace is extremely difficult, both in how I perceive others and also in how I view myself. Because I still have this lens that takes into account performance, competition, judgment. And so we're invited into grace because it provides us freedom from all those things. And then we close in verse 16. It says, "Don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one you obey, whether you are slaves to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you have come to obey from your heart the pattern of teaching that has now claimed your allegiance. You have been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness." And I acknowledge that, you know, Paul's use of the language of slavery feels offensive, you know, maybe even triggering, especially in the context of what it means, the abuse of power, the historic oppression of slavery. And I think it was probably just as offensive for the Roman citizens to be hearing this as well. Paul was inviting them to basically take on this role that was reserved for people that they felt were less than. For them, it meant that they had to give up status or give up control or to die to themselves. But in addition to that, I think maybe Paul's use of the metaphor of slave is actually communicating our compulsion to offer our loyalty and allegiance to someone or to something, even if that is ourselves. And because of our natural tendency to follow something, I think what Paul is inviting us to consider is actually a change of leadership. And so the third paradox we see here is that God's freedom isn't the absence of leadership or authority, which sounds freeing, but it's actually the presence of the right leadership to follow and imitate. René Girard was a French philosopher, and he developed this idea of mimetic desire. And mimetic just means to imitate or to mimic. And he proposed that human desires are simply imitations of the desires of others. Right? So you kind of see this played out at a young age. When a kid sees another kid pick up a toy, right, then every other kid in that room now wants that toy too. Or we see this played out in marketing and advertising, where it kind of plays into our tendency to want what others want. And so the desires of others become our desires, right? So I'm going to get a bit technical here, so hang with me. But Girard plays out what happens then in this model, right? And I've got some slides to help us. So there's one person, right, who's the model. And, you know, they show desire for an object. And so the other person, who's the imitator, now imitates the desire for that same object. The problem Girard identifies is that, you know, all of this imitation tends to be competitive, right? It usually results in some sort of violence or social harm. Because there's just not enough money, there's not enough fame, there's not enough relationships to go around for everyone. And so people need to fight each other for the same things. But over time, in order to alleviate conflict with each other, humans develop certain strategies, like scapegoating. Right? And scapegoating is putting all the violence onto an innocent individual or a group, which we've seen historically done to marginalized communities. But it unites those who were previously in conflict, and then it creates this false sense of peace. But the underlying mimetic desire is still there. And Girard believes that humans can't escape our mimetic nature. And if that's the case, then how do we solve this problem of violence that comes from our desires? And so one solution that's proposed is that we use our desires against our desires. Because if we're always going to have mimetic desires, then maybe the solution is to shift the source of what we're imitating, to shift it to a source of peace, because then peace becomes mimicked and passed on. Does that make sense? So this might not be the perfect example, but this, maybe it's like this. All right, so Jay-Z just dropped his 13th album this past week, 444, which apparently was the time, it's like the actual time he woke up when he wrote this title track. But he did an interview with Terry Gross a while back on Fresh Air, and he was talking about his experience growing up in the projects and then the transition of how he became a rapper and producer. And, you know, he said that growing up in the projects, there was just crack cocaine everywhere. Like, that's all he saw. You were either using it or you were dealing it. And so this desire to sell crack in order to make money, to support your family, that's what was mimicked, and that what was passed on throughout their entire community. Someone mentored him, someone showed him the ropes, someone gave him advice on the drug business. But while he was doing this, his passion for words, for rhymes, was starting to develop. And as he grew older, he began to realize the destruction that his street job was doing to his own community. And over time, as he got connected to individuals, you know, who would help him make demos, open doors to the music industry, he finally said he came to a point where he needed to leave the street business and jump completely into music, where he began to model and learn from those in the music industry. And it's that transition that eventually allowed him to really be focused on passing on his skills as a rapper. Instead of passing on his skills as a dealer. And if we go back Walter Gerard's theory, right? It essentially reflects what Paul is trying to communicate here, right? He's saying that we have a compulsion to imitate our desires. And so Paul is inviting us to shift the source of our desires and what we imitate. So instead of imitating brokenness or competition or violence, which is what he calls being slaves to sin, he invites us to imitate peace, forgiveness, grace, which is what he calls being slaves to righteousness. And that's what leads to freedom from this vicious cycle. And for us, maybe a question we can ask ourselves is who or what are we imitating? And as we reflect on our desires, you know, what is the source of those desires? Let me close with this. You know, as I reflect on our community here at Vox, I see a lot of parallels in just our experience of experiencing freedom in our journey as a community. So when we first started, we had the freedom as a church plant to do anything we wanted, right? We had dreams and expectations of what kind of church we wanted to be. We came up with the name Vox Veniae, which means voice of grace. And somehow we had the naive audacity to think that's what we would offer to this city and our neighborhood. But as we began to overextend ourselves, as we began to push ourselves to the brink of burnout, many of those dreams and expectations began to die. A lot of our close friends left the church, and it was painful, but necessary. And from that, we became more intentional about tending to the interior life, practicing self-awareness, right, through things like the Enneagram or nonviolent communication. And for me, you know, understanding who God made me to be has given me freedom to live, to pastor out of my true self, instead of living out other people's expectations of what I should be. And I think through the years, we've also been more intentional about trying to imitate a contemplative approach to faith. And I think that's given us freedom to simply be, where we focus less on doing things, but focus more on actually being and who we are. And so for us, as I think about the freedoms we're experiencing currently now, like I wouldn't have imagined that 10 years ago. And my hope and my prayer is that for us as a community, that we'll continue to experience and model this paradoxical freedom that God invites us to. So let me close with this prayer from St. Francis. Lord, make us instruments of your peace. Where there is hatred, let us sow love. Where there is injury, let us sow pardon. Where there is doubt, let us sow faith. Where there is despair, let us sow hope. Where there is darkness, let us sow light. And where there is sadness, let us sow joy. O divine Creator, grant that we may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to a full life. And so we pray this in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.